VanWeek Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. That can only mean this is the VanWeek Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWeek.
And I'm Adam VanWeek.
And we are here live as always. Where else are you going to get an hour of absolutely free, wonderful information that could literally help your finances for the rest of your life, except here? As usual, we will be talking about things that we would like to talk about unless you pick up the phone and dial 222-TALK. That's 222-8255 in the 904 area code. At that point, you will be put to the head of the line, and we will talk about what you would like to talk about, which kind of makes it even better advice for the same amount of money, being none. And if you think that's a bargain, you can come and see us for the same price. It's just not every week it's going to be the same price.
It isn't?
Not to come back once a week.
Well, the same person.
Same person, yeah. Yes. Everybody, though. In fact, I think I'm very seriously considering giving the show away free today. I wish the station would one time say that to me.
That would be nice.
They never have.
Yeah.
But I digress. All right. We welcome back all the regulars. Thanks so much for always being here. We really do depend on you. And if you're new to the show, either on purpose or by accident, please try to stick around for a while. There are so many things that you can do while you're getting smarter financially, from driving your car to, well, who knows, fixing a flat in a Chick-fil-A drive-up or most anything.
Wow. Yeah, that was random.
Not really.
Did that happen to you or something?
No. Okay. It happened to Marshall.
Ah.
But anyway, like I said, I digress. It must be the mood I'm in today. It certainly isn't because it was such a blockbuster week in the markets. But sometimes it doesn't take much news to feel pretty good. And I think this might qualify as one of those weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it felt pretty good to me.
I thought it felt pretty bad.
Did you?
Yeah, I sure did.
Well, that shows you. When nothing happens,
yeah. You
can take it either way.
And I wasn't alone, and I'll tell you why I know
Please do.
In a little bit. But, yeah, it was about as flat a week as you can find. But I'll take it. I mean, it was... Flat weeks are fine. There's nothing wrong with them. Sometimes you need that just to let the moving averages get closer to the actual trading levels. And the one thing it really did do was it caused a pretty drastic drop in bullish sentiment.
That was one of the reasons that I got real happy before the show, because I was reading about that.
Exactly.
And whatever they think, they being the public, we tend to think otherwise.
Well, it's not just us. I mean, that's a lot of people view it as a contrarian indicator. That means that whenever mom and pop investors are thinking everything is great, it's time to get in, that is not the time to get
that's
in.
Scary.
That's the time to get out.
That's so, like 2006 when everybody was buying up a home or two and taking big mortgages.
Yep.
Look what happened.
Exactly. When you, the way I heard it put was when the little old lady gets in the taxi cab and is talking to her driver about how they're both buying and flipping houses, that is not the time you want to be flipping houses.
No.
Leave that to the professionals. When they're doing it, that's a good time to do it. When they're getting out and the people who have no experience are getting in, that's a bad time.
Same thing
in the market. So yeah. So when mom and pop get scared, you're going to see, you tend to see periods of outperformance. Yeah. So that's good. The other interesting thing was this week, both bullish and bearish sentiment dropped. So it was kind of a very neutral week, just all around.
Reflected in the results?
The performance this week, the Dow led the way. It moved 20 basis points to the upside.
What do we do?
Yeah. The S&P ended the week with within 1 point of where it started. It was a 0% change. And the NASDAQ dropped a whole 0.1%. So for the quarter, all three look much better. Also the month, with the NASDAQ up 4.1, the Dow up 3.2, and the S&P up 3.1. So whoever, if you remember, I said don't listen to that sell in May and go away, and so far so good on that advice.
Mm-hmm.
For the year, only three sectors are ahead of the S&P 500's gain of 4.8%. Technology is leading the way. It's up 15.9%. Consumer discretionary is up 14.1%. And then healthcare is just ahead of the S&P at 4.9%. Energy made a pretty strong move to get back into the black, up 3.7% year to date, but it still lags the overall index. And then the worst performer is telecom. If that sounds familiar, that's because you probably heard it last year as well. It's down 11.9%. And then consumer staples and materials are just ahead of telecom, but still looking pretty ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the U.S.
This is the antithesis of 2016, where only the FANG stocks made money.
Right.
Now, this is really a broad-based general market rise that we're experiencing now. It's easier to find exceptions than it is finding exceptions in 2016, where all that was five stocks.
Yeah,
a couple of places that it's down, but generally a lot of things are above their 50-day moving average.
That's true.
That percentage is growing on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and I like that action because it doesn't require you to own Apple or something like that.
That's also true, although technology still is by far the clear winner.
Biggie, yeah.
So
QQQ is humming.
Yeah, a lot of this was caused by the drop in February, so we're still seeing everything shake out from that. No, we're still not back to our previous highs except in the NASDAQ. So a lot of this is still trying to regain those previous highs set in January.
We can't say, technically, that we're still in a bull market.
We cannot.
We need to take out the old highs on the S&P and the Dow, and at that point we can say this is now officially the second longest bull market in history.
That's right. There are some leading indicators that would indicate that mm-hmm. we are going to do that, but they're not reliable enough to say that it's definitely going to happen.
That is true.
So outside of the U.S., it's been a pretty bad year for stocks. China dropped again this week and brought the total performance for 2018 to -16.3%. Ouch.
Who do they think is going to win the trade war?
There you go. It's a direct result of the quote-unquote trade wars that Trump is stirring up. And China has a lot more to lose than the U.S. does in this battle. So I think he's kind of betting on that they'll flinch first. But they're also a very face-driven. They don't want to lose. They don't want to appear to have been weak towards us. So some of that might go on behind the scenes, and we might not hear about it. But I assume that that's what he's trying to do.
Very quietly, there was a trade deal signed that eliminated tariffs between two other countries, and you know that's going to set the stage for exactly what Trump's trying to do, which is get rid of tariffs.
I certainly hope so. We'll see how that all plays out.
We will.
The other person, or the other group of people that are going to get hurt in this are the U.S. consumer, because all of those goods that we do import from China, we buy, and they would all go up in price. So that would hurt us in the pocketbook a little bit. Mm-hmm. Still, it's way too early to tell if it's going to happen or not, but that would be the other area that would be hurt. So Brazil made a pretty astonishing rebound this month, gaining more than 12% in July. They're still down 9% for the year, but this past week alone, we saw a 5% gain. So they're not out of the woods yet, but it really helped the emerging markets index overall. It's still down about 6% on the year, but you can see that improvement because Brazil is such a big part of that. So that'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on. And then markets in Europe have been mixed this year. Most have not seen huge movements in either direction. For example, the UK, despite all the Brexit talk, is down less than 1% year to date. So Europe is just kind of flat. Brazil looks to be coming back. China, ouch.
Yeah, Theresa May kind of got her, how should I put this nicely? She kind of got her attitude readjusted a little bit when Trump was there. She's been trying to pull what she calls a soft Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is we'll say we're leaving, but we're not really leaving, are we? So
they need to do it. They need to pull the trigger.
But when you get a majority of 5 or 6% in any country about anything anymore, that is an overwhelming mandate. So you got to do it. You're absolutely right. All right, well, we'll have the trivia question when we get back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do have a trivia question today. It involves financial people. Advisors, as it were.
Okay.
How about that? Do you know that the average person over the long haul as an investor actually does better if they use a financial advisor than the peer group who does not use a financial advisor?
Well,
we would like to think that, wouldn't we?
I did know that, actually, but I've read a lot about it. So,
mm-hmm. Because After all, in our day jobs, that is precisely what we do. My question is, how much better do people who use advisors do on average than the group who doesn't use it? And I'll take it, it's an even number of percentage points. And I will take anything within, Adam knows the range, it's a very tight range, but try to figure that out.
All right.
Meanwhile, the only thing boring about this week was the results. As Adam pointed out, getting there was really a lot of complicated stuff, and we have not wrapped it all up yet. So we're going to just carry on a little bit in the market wrap and tell you about some things that were actually going on that are important.
It was kind of funny. I was writing this last night, and I actually ran out of room on my page. So, and before I got to everything I wanted to talk about. But commodities, I wanted to touch on them a little bit. They have really taken a turn for the worse in July after a very strong start to the year. The index has lost more than 4% this month alone. It's still up 2% on the year, and oil has been a pretty strong part of both of those moves. It's added more than 18% over the year, but it's down close to 6% in July. So it's really it helped the index on the way up in the beginning of the year, and it's helped bring it down in July. So just something to keep an eye on. It's been a while since we've seen stuff like that in commodities. So,
Well, you know the rules, folks. Callers to the head of the line. Good morning, Chuck.
Hey, good morning, Steve and Adam.
What's up today?
Hey, do you know next week is what they call Big Week?
Big Week. Is that earnings-wise or what's the...
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, there's a ton of it.
Yeah, more than 500 companies reporting next week.
Yeah. So, like, about a year ago, on one of Cramer's Friday game plans, he did something that I was already familiar with from studying World War II. And Big Week in World War II was a week when the Allies bombed the hell out of the Nazis and sent 1,000 B-17s and B-24s over each day for a whole week. And they were trying to demoralize them and engage them. And so anyway, Cramer did a game plan where he called this week where, you know, the major companies report, like we have Amazon, Facebook, Google, and a whole bunch of S&P companies.
Right.
And so he tied those two together. So this is what I call and what he's called Big Week, which is, you know, this is the biggest week of earnings, you know, each quarter.
Right. It is. That's right.
Yeah.
I agree with his assessment. I don't always agree with Cramer, but on this one I do.
Yeah. He's interesting.
He is very interesting.
I can't think of a better word. So what's your prediction now? Adam and I were discussing in the break that neither of us can understand why the world is so negative. Everything's negative now, and I know it's largely political, but financial too. Financial people are so negative.
They are.
They're saying, oh, well, the earnings beat rate may be a spectacular 73.8%, but just wait. Yeah, I don't get it.
Well, you'll know. If you pretty much look at historically every quarter, the first 2 or 3 weeks of the quarter, their earnings war reports come out of the woodwork and that are all over the airwaves.
Sure.
Trying to talk the market down. And everybody's worried, oh, these earnings aren't going to be as good as predicted. And then usually they end up being better than predicted. And we'll have to see what happens next week during Big Week. But, you know, I think that's when things start to turn around.
You have to wonder if those negative talking heads are buying in large chunks right before they go on Bloomberg and Fox Business.
You wonder,
and
don't
talk it down, because it is. It's just like clockwork. You're right. Every quarter, the first few weeks, you can't turn on the TV to a business channel without seeing that.
Does that sound familiar if I would say Christmas sales?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the media starts in about, it probably happens starting in October, where, oh, this is going to be such a dismal Christmas season, and they'll cry all the way through Thanksgiving, and they'll cry all the way through Christmas, and then after the first of the year, the numbers come in, they say, oh, well, it was actually pretty good. And it happens every year. It's unbelievable. That's why we're so contrary. Whatever you hear is probably wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you play that? You wait and see. I never anticipate the market. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think next week will tell a lot about how the market's going to be. But Yeah, you know, in fact, I'm fascinated by your question. I'm going to take a stab at it and say, your trivia question, I'm going to take a stab at it and say 3%. 3%.
Well, that was a pretty accurate stab since you nailed it. Now, if you're using an advisor who, let's just throw out a number, 1%, and you're getting a 3% better return, who costs money and who makes money, or is everybody happy?
Yeah, so we would have taken 2% because that would have been the net gain.
Yeah, I didn't specify whether it was gross or net of a 1% fee. And we charge anywhere from 1.5% down to 1% depending on the size of the account. But on average, it's a 1% pay the advisor, and you get 3% on average back. Now, we can't promise it. We won't promise it. Nobody can promise it. But those are the statistics, and statistically, it pays to use a financial advisor, which I find very interesting. How about that? So, good job. How about we put you on hold? We'll get your address and send you a little something from Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm.
I'm sure we've got his address. I'm pretty sure Chuck has one before, but still, just in case, give it to Ellen, we'll take it anyway.
All right, good. Anything else today, Chuck?
I think he's gone.
All right, then. Good morning, Ron.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Recently, I sold a covered call that is due this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I sold it at 109, and the stock is already above 111. And as of Friday, I still own the stock. I'm not sure exactly when someone's going to come along and buy my stock at 109.
Probably on or before expiration date.
Okay.
That is the downside to covered calls.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you just learned it.
Hand it over, fella.
I'm still making money. I'm not probably making as much as I could have. You know?
Okay. Well, good. It covered that spread. So
exactly.
Yeah.
That's why it's such a wonderful philosophy. But you got to take the time to study it. You got to know exactly what you're doing. Have you ever charted options on a piece of paper, a graph paper? It tells you exactly where you break even and hold and make money and all that. If you look it up, learning to chart those things, you'd be amazed how much you'll learn just learning to do the charts. It's incredible.
Okay. Now, my other question was, it's at 111 currently. What if it's J.P. Morgan. What if J.P. Morgan suddenly slides and it goes back to, say, 109?
Yeah.
Would somebody exercise the call?
Nope.
Most
at 110, or would they,
it's possible.
It depends if it's in the money at all. If it's in the money, it'll happen. If it's out of the money.
Yeah.
And that's what the charting will tell you. It shows you the exact point at which your call is no longer in the money.
Right.
Okay.
And so the odds are that if it drops, then you won't, you will still own
those
shares.
You'll still own the stock.
Yeah.
You sell another covered call, pocket the money from the other one.
Right.
Right. And I sold it for $1.08, so I figure my break-even point, as far as I could have made more, is $110.
Yep.
$08. Yep. So I'm only a dollar a share. It's like $111.11 right now. I'm only a dollar a share. Worse off than I would have been if I hadn't sold it.
Right.
Good luck. Maybe it'll drop, and you can do it all over again.
And if it doesn't, you know what? I can always buy it back and do this again.
Exactly. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Very good strategy. I talked to you about this about 3 weeks ago.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just fell onto it. So I think I'm going to continue to do this. This is a good thing.
You'll get real comfortable, and you'll get really good at graphing it. You just glance at that graph, and it'll tell you exactly what to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite amazing.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you again. Keep up the good work, and enjoy your show. I listen to you every week.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
So a couple things I think that brought up a couple of great topics. Yeah. One is that's one thing you have to be careful with covered calls is that if you have highly appreciated stock in a taxable account, you'd not want to write covered calls on it because there is always the possibility that you will have to sell those shares. And that if Ron, let's say he purchased these a long time ago at $30 and now he has to sell them at 109 because he got called. And that would be a huge capital gains issue for him. So
that's why it makes so much sense to do it in an IRA.
Right, right.
And that is, as we said a couple of weeks ago, that is the only type of option play you can do in an IRA because it's the one that carries the least risk.
But what normally happens in a covered call is that he sold that for $1.08, mm-hmm. and someone had that option owned, and it would most likely outcome is that it would expire. Ron gets the $1.08 a share, still owns his stock, which didn't really move that much during the time period he owned it. So he essentially charged someone else rent to borrow that stock for a while.
Yeah, and if it ran up Monday, for instance, to 113, somebody's probably just going to exercise that thing. Boom, they'll take his stock and they'll simultaneously sell it,
exactly.
Pocket the $2 or $3 difference, and then they'll go back to work and do it again.
Yep.
You can learn a lot about these online, Investopedia. There are a number of ways you can do it. But I really like the charting. When I was studying for the CFP exam many, many years ago, I learned how to do all of that. And you can't imagine how much clearer it becomes exactly what you're doing. All right, we've got a little more wrap-up to do right after the break. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Van Wee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And you know, that trivia question got answered so quickly, I never really got to fully credit to Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 636-7888, and that is a 904 number. And more than likely, Ken will pick up the phone himself.
And as far as the what you would win is, I had lunch with Ken yesterday at the Homestead Restaurant. And
good.
He is going to get cards from the Homestead. We don't have them yet, so I know I owe one from last week to mm-hmm. Edward and now Chuck. So just hold on. I will have those for you shortly.
And speaking of Edward, you know that it is a proven fact that people who listen to talk radio are the smartest audience of any particular audience for any kind of media in the country. And that was proven last week because he did a time value of money trivia question in his head and nailed it.
And I'll tell you, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I can hold my own. Oh, my gosh. Did I screw that
Boy,
up?
Why did he put his foot in his mouth there? Huh?
Dad is always right.
Yeah. Well, that's what I tell him. But I couldn't do that calculation in my head. So, wow. I'm impressed.
It just proves it. You know, Rush Limbaugh has said for years, all of his polling, every time comes out the same, the smartest audience in the world is that listening to talk radio. So, kind of got to believe it when it's staring you right in the face, right? Anyway, we have just a couple more comments on that before I move along, and you can pick
a couple more. I just wanted to real briefly touch on fixed income. It's been rebounding pretty strongly here in this part of the year, but this week was kind of an exception to that. The only bright spot was short treasuries gained 2 basis points. Every other classification of bond was more or less down this week, and the aggregate bond market is still down around 1.5% on the year. So we've got probably 2 more rate hikes this year, although Trump has really been rallying against that. I don't understand that at all.
I don't either.
But whatever. He's not going to be able to affect it. Trust me, the Fed's going to do what the Fed's going to do. Yeah. And that is probably not going to be favorable for bonds in the short term. So I don't know if we'll get back to positive for the year, but we should see a little bit of improvement and then some declines around those rate hikes is my speculation.
I'll give you the reason for that. The more rate hikes we get, the stronger the dollar gets, because demand for dollars go up when they're paying you better. He doesn't want the dollar any stronger because it makes it very difficult for our manufacturers and other exporters to make money, because our goods become more expensive to other people when the dollar gets higher. So a lower dollar means more production at home. A higher dollar can mean less. On the other hand, we are at capacity in terms of our labor force.
Yeah. And, you know, with rate hikes, there's always an upside and a downside.
Always.
Same thing with rate cuts. There's always an upside and a downside. So right now, I think I understand why he's saying it, but he's just flat out wrong, in my opinion, because we talk about it weekly that we've been punishing savers for too long. We need to get back to a normal long-term historic trend interest rate level, and we are not there yet. But
no, and the market's only factoring in the next 18 months two or three more quarter point increases, and I think they're just naively low.
I think it's a little low too. I think we're looking at five. Yeah, I would guess at least four.
Yeah, but we'll see. As you said, the Fed will do what the Fed will do, and it will not matter one iota to them what he says or what you say or what I say.
Absolutely not, and it shouldn't, and that's good. There should be a separation. It should matter what I say. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
something like that. So we touched briefly on earnings. I want to go a little bit deeper, not too deep because it's pretty early in the season, but the earnings beat rate so far looks great. It's at 73.6. It is substantially higher than every quarter we've seen since 2006. Of course, that is subject to change. The revenue beat rate, a little bit lower than the last two quarters, still ahead of most quarters since 2011, though. It stands at 68.6, and it's just remember that it's early. And also, forward guidance has been fairly negative this season. Not a great sign, but there's an upside. There's a lot of turmoil and junk in the political and the news lately. And I think that it sounds like some of the companies are even buying into this. So let's see how it shakes out this week. And I think it was Chuck that mentioned big week. And this a lot will change during the next 5 to 7 days.
You hear me periodically kind of razzing the market or the experts or whatever, because when you're giving out the winners and losers on the economic data front most weeks, there'll be at least one or two of them that are so stupid because the math doesn't work is the reason one of them is, but some of them are, well, they're based on these expectations that are absolutely ludicrous. So of course they didn't beat it. And that's part of what's going to happen now with the diminished expectations going into Q3. We'll probably beat the heck out of it.
It's very possible. We'll see. But you can't even begin to guess Q3 until we've seen all of Q2. So.
Which is why I say we don't predict the market and base our portfolio design on that prediction, because we're not good enough and nobody else is either.
No, it doesn't happen. Studies show that if you beat the market 1 year, there's a very strong chance you will underperform it by a pretty wide margin the next year.
That's right. All right, lines are open, 222-8255. Inflation, part two. Inflation is a cycle like everything else in economics, business, all that. And it has a three-stage lifespan. Stage one, it starts in the early part of things, manufacturing, production, and so on, when all of a sudden producers are paying more for the raw goods. And boy, did we see that in the prices paid index this past week, up just sharply higher. But it's been going on for quite some time. So we have passed that now. It takes 6 to 8 months for that to work through, and that has actually happened. Now, the second part is the move, which took place in 11, and it's still happening now, when the price of the finished goods, in other words, there's a manufacturing cycle, so they start to pay more for goods. They don't raise their price the second the goods come in. The only people that are good at doing that are gas station owners.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a reason, too. That tank's going to empty itself and be replaced at more money. So,
inelastic demand.
Exactly right. So we are in that. You're starting to see it trickle down in the producer price index and that sort of thing. And then you get down to level three, and this is when it becomes a problem. And this is where we're headed unless I am absolutely crazy. And that's when the price of finished goods remain elevated so long that people start to demand raises and higher wages. Now, you've seen wages start to move up. That's we're entering that part. But it hasn't become a big deal yet. And it's partly because of the masking of the numbers that's done, as Adam points out, so frequently, because older people at their peak earning power are leaving the market, being replaced by the younger people who are just beginning their earning. Every time one of those swaps takes place, wage averages go down a little bit, even though you might be paying the rookie a heck of a lot more than you would have 2 years ago. So you can't take this all cast in stone. But what's happening now, and you can see it in layoffs and things like that, the worker, in other words, labor is starting to get its returns again. I've talked in the past about the the factors of production, land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. But land and capital have been paying for themselves pretty well for the last 10 years or so. Labor has been left behind over the last 10 years. And entrepreneurs, of course, have been making all kinds of money as business conditions improve and markets improve and so on. So what's happening now is labor is playing catch-up, and that is the real sign. Now you know we're heading into an inflationary cycle. Now, last week I talked about it quite a bit, but I didn't get around to telling you what to do about it. So I'm going to, right after this break, I'm going to recap what the premise from last week. And by the way, if you go to our website, VanWeFinancial.com, my blog from last week is called In Praise of the Chapwood Index. The Chapwood Index is what I call the true measure of inflation, and that's the one that showed Jacksonville last year had an 8.6% cost of living increase, not the 2 or 2.5% that the government is reporting, and that is very common. And it's all in there, and I'll kind of pick up right on top of the Chapwood Index after the break and tell you the things that you can do as an individual investor to help yourself get through a period of inflation without actually losing your purchasing power. There are a few things that actually love it when inflation is rampant again. So with that in mind, we will have a pretty thorough analysis of what to do about it as soon as we come back. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
This segment sponsored by Robinson Landscape and Maintenance. Give Troy a call at 662-9794. All right. Inflation. It the arch enemy of people my age, obviously, and of everybody who is on a fixed income. So last week I started talking about how the Consumer Price Index is what the government uses to measure inflation, and it ought to be accurate, right? Yeah, right. It ought to be is the right thing. Since the government is charged with the production of the Consumer Price Index, it might be interesting to note who charged them with it. They did. They have an inherent conflict of interest in producing accurate numbers. That conflict of interest comes from the extra costs that they would be paying in terms of Social Security recipients, interest on tips, and all kinds of things.
And this problem has, or this conflict of interest has grown over time.
Yes.
So today it is so big that the numbers, we just can't even visualize what the numbers would actually be.
Oh.
if they indexed Social Security to inflation, actual inflation. Oh, my gosh.
They're prolonging the bankruptcy of America for how long? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either.
There's only three ways to get out of debt, and they're not taking any of them except the inflationary part. We print money and pay your bills, but I'll get to more of that, too. For the last 10, 11 years, why didn't we hear much about this? Well, the genesis of all the no inflation talk, as well as the ZIRP, zero interest rate policy, it was back in the housing crisis of 07 when things fell so much. Because housing is the biggest cost in the CPI, they were able to look us in the eye and tell us, well, we're not going to pay anything on tips because inflation is going negative, things like that. Well, anybody who was buying anything that wasn't a home or an apartment or a condo knows that that was about the only thing going down, except when oil plummeted and our gas tanks got a little cheaper. All those things are behind us now, and it's getting harder and harder. And the government trying to fix it, if I may, has started doing the Social Security COLAs on something called the chained CPI, which means it factors in changes in behavior. When something gets too expensive, we buy something cheaper. Well, the Federal Reserve has its own way of masking that also. It's called the PCE, or Personal Consumption Expenditure. The purpose of the core PCE is to have the Fed look at the numbers and produce the number that they're estimating. So if they say we want to target 2, guess what it's going to come out? It's going to come out 2. It's just like the Chinese GDP. Well, China, what do you think the number will be next quarter? Oh, probably 7%. Okay, China thinks it's 7%.
Yeah.
Real number comes out a month later. What is it? 7%?
Imagine.
It's incredible. These people's forecasting ability is just amazing. Anyway, there are two kinds of economists. The ones who are correct are called monetarists. That's the Milton Friedman, von Mises, that group, Friedrich Hayek. And the other ones are the Keynesians, like Keynes and Paul Krugman, who has yet to be right about anything despite his Nobel Prize in economics. In fact, he predicted, if Trump won the election, that the stock market would tank. And said, how long will it take for it to come back? And his answer was, never. Okay, Paul.
No bias there, though.
Don't buy the book. I assume he's got a book. I don't know. I wouldn't buy it. Anyway, it's because of all these reasons that Ed Butowski developed the Chaplet Index to tell us what's really going on out there. And when you read it and read about the methodology, you'll be nodding as you go through it. There's a great explanation. Just Google it. It'll come right up. And in Jacksonville, it is one of the cities they track. So I know it's pertinent. It comes directly to us with our own set of numbers. So what does it mean? I'm not teaching a class in economics. I'm actually here to talk about investing. And so we'll talk about investing.
So
there
what
are
do?
Some things.
What do you buy?
Well, the general investments that love inflation are called commodities or other alternative investments. Food, energy, metals, real estate. Personally, I consider real estate a commodity if it's not your primary residence. And then I don't consider it an investment. I consider it a lifestyle addition. So I don't include personal residences as an investment. So let's start with commodities. Most people don't want to buy commodities directly because, hey, how many pork bellies can one family consume, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't want to have to take delivery on a contract for pork bellies.
You know, how about a train load of corn dumped on your front lawn?
No.
Probably not. So what do we do about it? Well, most investors will use options, index funds, or some other form of ownership for commodities. And our wonderful, flexible markets happen to have made this easy. And where there's a void, some smart person is going to step right in and fill it. The general commodities index can be purchased in any number of exchange-traded funds. I use, just out of force of habit, there's nothing special about it, the one called DBC.
Aha, uh-huh. But let me throw this in there. You should actually not buy that. You should buy DBAC. Okay. It is DBC without a K-1.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. And yeah. We'll get into the tax ramifications of that. But that would be very pleasant for me, for you, and for everybody listening, because K-1s are just that one more
pain
at tax time every year. Anyway. They are all basically the same in that they use options to estimate or depict which way the commodities are going. The reason I like the ETFs is very simple. They're marketable. Here I have to back up a little bit. Most people misunderstand the term liquid, the term marketable. Liquidity implies that you can sell something instantly, turn it into cash, and not lose a penny of principal. Marketable is exactly the same thing, disregarding that part about your principal. You can sell it immediately at the market price. You could make money, you could lose money. It's irrelevant, but it's still marketable. Unlike a hunk of real estate where you actually own it, and that is neither, because it can't be done quickly, and you can't guarantee anything about the prices. Although it does tend to go up over time, which is wonderful for homeowners, is it not? So when it comes to real estate, there are actually three ways to own it virtually, in other words, electronically. And those three ways would be to either have a mutual fund, a real estate exchange-traded fund, or a REIT. When I'm investing in real estate as an asset class, as part of my asset allocation, I prefer the REITs because they're a little bit special in a couple ways. But first, let's break them down. REITs come in three basic forms. Mortgage REITs, which own, guess what, mortgages, and equity REITs, which own the properties, and the hybrid REITs, which can have both in the same REIT. I prefer equity REITs because they have that one nice thing about them. If the property appreciates in a rising market, your REIT is going to appreciate as you get your quarterly dividends, some of which are pretty nice. So it's all of those things wrapped together that makes me want to be a real estate investor, not with my name on the title, but electronically. I just don't ever want to be called the L word again in my life, and a lot of people are like that. L stands for landlord. Ooh, I just shudder. Precious metals. one of the most sought-after investments. A lot of people like to buy the physical ones. You're inundated on TV all the time with the physical metals, buy this, buy that. I don't like that so much. Yeah, it's pretty, it feels good and all that, but when it comes time when you really, when you know you ought to be selling it, you take it out and you look at it and you think about going out to Acorn or something like that, and you say, nah, this is kind of pretty. Whereas if you own it in an exchange-traded fund, you just get on the computer, hit the sell button, and bang, it's gone. If you're going to invest in metals, decide how low you want to buy them and how high you want to sell them, and be prepared to do so in both directions, because buying low and selling high is the only thing in investing that will never change if you want to be a successful investor. All right, that's why the little guys, for those of you playing the home game, we love the ETFs, IAU, GLD, SLV, that sort of thing. And you can always call us and talk more about them if you want. One more word on gold. You hear many commercials nowadays for gold IRAs. I would not touch them. I have not yet proven to myself that the government has made that legal following years and years of it not being legal to have physical possession of the gold in your IRA. You want to talk about that, you can call us too. All right.
One quick note. That's, yep. I said DBAC. It's actually PDBC is the no K-1 commodity.
Great, yeah. Thanks. Mm-hmm. All right, there are two other things that love inflation. The first one is TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Bonds. You can buy those in a number of ETFs. The easiest one to remember is TIP. Pays you monthly, has two components of return for the underlying interest and the inflation rate. The other thing that loves inflation is the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy the general stock market, the one Adam likes is the whole darn thing. Over time, inflation rises, numbers get bigger, profits get bigger, and the index will rise. Pretty hard to beat that one.
Definitely.
So that's what you do about it. Well, we'll see you next week. This has been a lot of fun. Congratulations to the winners. And this is the Banway Financial Hour.